Three Man City, please? Bum, bum. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 197th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The links to the recordings of the previous 196 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com, and you can find that under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most do, listen later. Next Sunday, my guest will be organizational and leadership consultant and acclaimed poet, Dr. Sheila Murphy. Now to this week's show, the 197th, as I mentioned. Callers may call them at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers in until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is the attorney, writer, and independent publisher, Roxanne Bland. Good evening, Roxanne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, where did you first grow up and go to early school, Alexa?
My first dog. I'm sorry. Did you say that?
No. Where did you first grow up and go to early school?
Oh. I'm sorry. You have this lovely New York accent, you see, and I'm from Washington D.C., and so we can't understand you guys up there. Well, actually, I was born in Akron, Ohio, and I spent the first 9 years of my life there, a nice little Midwestern girl, and then we moved to Washington, D.C., and I attended elementary school there. And I think it was when I moved to D.C. that when I first started feeling like an alien, you know, the stranger in a strange land, because the culture of the Midwest and the culture of Washington, D.C. couldn't have been more different. I was very confused. I had no idea. And I think the children I went to school with also thought of me as an alien. So I did make it through elementary school, but I will say that when I was 10, I wrote a science fiction story. So it was my very first science fiction story. And it won a citywide contest. And that was fun. That was really, if you will, my first validation as a writer. And I absolutely loved writing it. I don't remember much about the story. It was a long, long, long time ago. But the one thing I remember is the fire was black, and the name of the planet was Zoin. And the children, it was about a bunch of children who found this portal to a different planet. And then, of course, they had to figure out how to get back. And like I said, the planet's name was Zoin, and the fire was black. That's all I remember about the story. But anyway, it was in elementary school that I started percolating my stories. I've always told myself stories ever since I was a little girl. I mean, a little girl. And because I felt so isolated and alienated from the neighborhood in which I grew up, I spent a lot of time by myself. And what did I do? I either read books or I told myself stories. I wasn't writing them down, but I told myself stories. And that's really how I got through elementary school.
I was an alien in Washington, D.C. for one summer, and I lived at 2901 South Dakota Avenue, which is right near Bladensburg Road, near Rio Grande Avenue. And it was after my father died, my mother moved down with a brother for a year before she thanked the Lord, took me back to New York City. So I might have had not only the New York accent, but one summer of the D.C. accent. Had you been a voracious reader before you got to D.C., or did D.C. push you into reading more and more?
No, I was always a voracious reader. My oldest sister, taught me to read when I was 4. So before I even started school, I was reading. And I read everything I could get my hands on. I remember one evening we were at a family member's house, and this particular family member happened to be in college. And she couldn't believe that I could read. And so she handed me one of her college textbooks, and I read it. I didn't understand what all the words meant, but I read it. And that's what I mean. I just read everything I could. I read the dictionary. I just read everything I could get my hands on. My parents didn't censor my reading, and so I could read everything. I read their books. They had a lot of political books, like Is Paris Burning and things like that. And I read that. I just read everything. And that did not change, you know, when we moved to D.C. I was always the reader. I used to hole up in my room for hours on end just reading. And I remember I built a bookshelf on my bed with my to-be-read and my currently reading pile. So I used to sleep with books. So I guess that kind of gives you an idea.
I do. What kind
of reader I was.
I have more books in my house than the Barnes & Noble because I tend to keep them. Early in life, you also settled into another of the arts. Tell us about your years with the piano.
Well, I started playing piano. Well, again, my oldest sister taught me how to play the piano when I was about 4. I played by ear. I did not know how to read music. And then at 7, I started taking piano lessons formally. And turns out I was pretty good at it. And I played music all through my teen years. I went to a fine arts high school, and was my original career goal, well, actually my very first career goal was to be a jockey, but then when I grew larger than the jockeys, that was out. My second career goal, if you will, was to be a concert pianist. And, yeah, I was that good. I was accomplished. I mean, I'm not trying to toot my own horn when I say that. I was truly an accomplished pianist. And what happened? Well, I was 17 years old. I didn't feel confident in myself, and I didn't do the things that I could have done to make a career out of music. And so I ended up, you know, in just a run-of-the-mill major in college and so on and so forth. But back to the music. I also played the oboe very badly. I played the bass trombone, not so badly. I was in a citywide orchestra. and we traveled to Japan 1 year.
Wow.
It was my senior year of high school. We traveled to Japan. Now that we spent a month there, traveling the country and playing. That is one of the most cherished memories that I have. Is hanging out in Japan, being a kid hanging out in Japan.
Wow,
and it was great.
You also kept your exploration of fiction going. Tell us about your developing reading interests.
Well, when I was 10, 11, 12, I was really big on mysteries. Agatha Christie, people like that. And then I graduated to horror, Stephen King, Peter Straub. And then, I mean, I read a little science fiction at this time because my sister was really into it. My oldest sister, once again, she was really into it. And I read a couple of her books, but I don't know. I was still into my mysteries and my horror and things like that. And I started reading Robert Heinlein when I was, a junior in high school. And it got me interested. His ideas got me interested in the genre. And then when I went to college, I just went all out. I read every science fiction fantasy book I could find. I was really into high fantasy at the time, you know, Lord of the Rings, things like that. But science fiction, I mean straight science fiction, also became a love of mine. So I guess you could say it wasn't really until college that this love affair with science fiction and fantasy really blossomed.
You mentioned Stephen King. Stephen King's book on writing is the best book I've ever read on writing, and everyone that I've spoken to that has read that book says the same thing. Is the craft of writing, you know, and how he goes about it and how he does it and everything. Terrific book.
I agree 100%. 100%. Although I don't quite agree with him about adverbs. An adverb here or there isn't going to kill you. But I do believe that too many of them will.
Even though music and fiction had been your overriding interest since childhood, neither were what you studied in college. Please tell us about your college. Where and what direction did you take there?
Well, when I was in college, I had thought to go, still thinking about going into music. So I went to their music department and auditioned and, you know, gave them the once over. And though their music department was very, very good, it wasn't stellar.
Where did you go to college?
Smith College.
Okay.
And it wasn't stellar. And, you know, if I wanted stellar, I should have gone to Juilliard. And so I backed off of music. That was really the last time I was really into music at all. And I haven't played music for years and years and years now. But anyway, what that did, though, it freed me up for other areas of study. And at first I thought I was going to be a theology major. And then my mother was like, well, how are you going to get a job with that? Oh, okay, Mom. So then I turned towards a major that Smith calls government, which I guess most other schools would probably classify as political science. And so I became a government major. And that was kind of fun because one of the things that Smith did was it wasn't just, you know, going through the roster of current governments and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. What it was, we also studied ancient governments and like Greek and Roman governments and things like that. And that was fun. I enjoyed that immensely. I completed my major in 2 years because that's all I had left. While I was trying to decide what to do, Smith gives you 2 years to decide what you want to do in terms of a major. And when my 2 years was up, the only major I could complete in 2 years was government. So that's what I did. And, you know, it was fun. It was fun. It wasn't as fun as, you know, science fiction and fantasy. I'd love to have been a major there, have been like an English minor in science fiction and fantasy. Oh, I would have been an English major. But it was fun enough, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It was enough to keep my attention.
Go ahead.
I say, and that's, you know, if I'm bored, then, you know, I'm bored. I tune you out. So the fact that it was enough to keep my attention is saying something, especially when you tell people, well, I majored in government, and they look at you like, oh, my God, you poor, boring preacher. But it wasn't that way at all.
I had a similar experience, not with theology, but I started as a philosophy major. And then I noticed that there weren't many jobs for philosophers in the New York Times. So I've switched to something much more practical, English literature, which there weren't many jobs during the service major either. Did you write for school papers or for literary magazines while you were either in high school or in college?
Actually, no, I didn't. I hung out with my friends and, you know, studied for school and things like that. But I didn't do anything like that. Smith College did have a paper. But you know, those were for people who were more of the journalism bent. And it wasn't that they were snotty or anything like that, but it was definitely a club. And if you weren't a member of the club, it's not that anyone would say anything to you or anything like that, but you had this distinct feeling that you were unwelcome. So I didn't do that at all. I would have liked, as I recall now, I would have liked to have had my own radio show because Smith College had a radio station that was basically heard on campus and on campus only. I would love to have had my own radio show. That would have been fun. But, again, you know, it's not something I thought about back then. And so, you know, I didn't do it. So, basically, like I said, I hung out with my friends. I studied and, you know, did what most college students do. Although I didn't really get into pranks that much.
And then after college, then what?
Well, after college, I spent 2 years, two and a half years, I guess, in New York City. I was a paralegal, and I worked for the major big law firms, what we call big law, the huge law firms, you know, with like 75, 100 partners, that kind of law firm.
Kind of
and, yeah. And I worked in a couple of those firms for, you know, like I said, a couple of years. And then, since all my friends were going to law school, I decided, well, I guess I'll go to law school. So I applied to Tulane School of Law and got in. So that's basically how that happened. I more or less fell into it. And let me tell you, if I had known that a decision I'd made on almost a whim 30 years ago, 35 years ago, would be affecting me today like this, I would never have gone to law school, ever.
I got into technology just by the quirk, and it was the best thing that happened to me because for years, I was a computer person, both on Wall Street and my own business, and writing about it and consulting. So I was very lucky there. Now, the law school, you mentioned Tulane, that brought you to still another part of the country. What special impact, if any, did New Orleans have on you? Very, very different lifestyle and everything down there.
Oh, I absolutely love New Orleans. This was, remember, this was way pre-Katrina. And I absolutely love New Orleans. I fell in with a group of like-minded people. And when I say like-minded, I mean people who read science fiction and fantasy. So I was pretty much in my element. And I, you know, we hung out together, we read books, we discussed books. And it was really, in that sense, well, let's put it this way. The only thing that marred the whole experience was that I was in law school. So that was my New Orleans experience. I mean, it was just I still love New Orleans to this day. I mean, Orleans was just absolutely fabulous, both as a city, as a place to find people who were a little bit on the wild side. And when I say wild side, I don't mean, you know, really out there. What I mean is that these are people who know themselves and are rather uninhibited about it. And that was so refreshing to see because, you know, law school people are buttoned up, you know, always competing with each other, stabbing each other in the back. You know, this was not an environment I wanted to be in.
Oh, yeah. I had friends who went to Harvard Law who told me about people stealing notes at the end of the semester before tests and everything. Yeah. Well, any city that's home to both Fats Domino and to Herb Alpert can't be all bad, right? So.
Oh, let me tell you. And I used to do that. I rode a bicycle when I was in New Orleans because I didn't have a car. And I hung out at the French Quarter. Those jazz clubs, it's closed now, but there was a place called Storyville. I used to go down there and have oysters and champagne and watch the band. Oh, it was great. It was just absolutely wonderful.
Do you know that before Elvis Presley, Fats Domino had more gold records than anyone in the United States at a time that Frank Sinatra didn't have one. Frank Sinatra's first gold record was Strangers in the Night, and by that time, Fats Domino had 9 or 10. So
I can believe that.
Yeah.
I can believe that.
What was your legal specialty? What kind of a lawyer did you want to be?
Well, I trained to become an admiralty lawyer. That has to do with the shipping industry.
Right.
Law of the sea, yeah. I learned a lot about seaworthiness and unseaworthiness, who's responsible for personal injuries and death at sea. I learned a lot about bareboat charters and things like that. It was fun. It was fun. I did enjoy my admiralty classes, although now as I look back on it, this field was just starting out and nobody was doing it. Space law. And I think back now, and I think, you know, that would have been so much fun. Space law?
Sure.
Ooh. So, anyway, like I said, nobody was doing it back then. Well, anyway, what happened was in 1986, the bottom of the shipping industry fell out because of the oil plunges in oil prices and various other things. And so my specialty and admiralty pretty much meant nothing.
Well, then you went back to D.C. What kind of work did you say in a legal profession then?
Well, what I did was I ended up doing probate law.
Oh, okay.
And that was horrible. You know, I had a professor in law school who was trying to convince me to go into private practice. And I said, you know, I really don't want to do that. I can't imagine myself in private practice. And he said, well, just try it. You know, I've had students who said the same thing. They went into private practice and they loved it. And I said, all right, you know, kind of reluctantly. So I got a job as a probate attorney in private practice and absolutely hated it. Absolutely hated it. First of all, I think it a lot had to do with the area of law that I was in. it is not the most pleasant. People get very weird when it comes to money. And when someone dies, they get even weirder. And, you know, when you're dealing with clients who, for even before the death in the family or whatever, you're dealing with clients who hated each other, and all of their animosities come out, that's pretty tough. You know, because you've got to, well, first of all, you've got to keep your temper. You've got to, you know, sit there and try to mediate and broker an agreement without smacking somebody for being stupid. And that was very difficult for me. That took a toll on me. So I ended up leaving private practice. And I ended up in working for a trade organization.
I had always wanted to go to law school, not that I wanted to practice, but I was interested in the law, and I still am. And I wound up taking a boring job after college with the insurance company because they were going to pay for law school. And during the first year, the real property and personal property courses took the bloom off law school for me, as did the insurance company job. And I was very lucky to have an opportunity to get on the ground floor of computer stuff. So it was a whole. If it weren't for not liking law school, I wouldn't have had the life that I have now. You mentioned in a note to me that all during your life you've been writing stories that never saw the light of day, as you described it. Why not? Why had you never attempted to publish?
Well, I think it's two things. I think it's one, there's the confidence issue. Are these really good enough? And B, I really didn't know how to go about doing it. I didn't take the time. I didn't even know where to begin to look. And there was no one around me who could give me any advice. And, of course, you know, this is pre-internet. You know, everything you wanted to look up, you had to go to the library, and the library was not close to me. And it was just kind of wandering in the dark. And also, too, I think about those stories today and realize that, three, soon to be four, published novels under my belt, I kind of came to realize, well, you know, the ideas were good, but the execution left a lot to be desired. But at least I was writing, you know? And I was trying out my chops. I wasn't honing my chops. Let's just say I was trying out my chops. And that was a good thing. That was a good thing because it got me interested in the back of my mind, in the back of my head. It got me interested in writing and actually putting my ideas down on paper, which I, except for that one story when I was a child, I hadn't been doing at all. Those stories are locked up in my head. I never wrote anything down. So when I started doing these little short stories, you know, that was really kind of the piece of the dam breaking, let's put it that way.
I find short stories the hardest thing to do. I've been a columnist for years, and then I got into poetry and to a novella. But with short stories, you have to do so much in a constrained framework that you have to both develop the characters, the scene, and everything else. I find that harder than anything else. That's what I do.
That is absolutely correct, I think. Short stories are one of the most difficult story forms to write. And I'll tell you what's even more difficult, at least I find it difficult, is flash fiction.
Yes.
Flash fiction is a story. Now, The you know, it depends on who you ask. But generally, it seems to be a complete and entire story in 1,500 words or less. A lot of people agree that the number is about 1,000 or even 700.
Yeah.
That is very difficult to do. I tried my hand at flash fiction, and it was pretty bad. So bad in the sense that it was like this is going to be a novella. You know, I can't condense this into 700 words. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a mindset that you have to write short stories and flash
fiction
and things like that.
There are some great short story writers. Sure, it took a life event to get you seriously into writing. What happened?
Well, something as mundane as falling ill. That year there were two strains of flu going around, and I got both of them. And so between the two of them, I was out of the office for like a month. And you know how you reach a point where you're too sick to stand up, but you're not so sick that you sleep all the time? And I was at that point, and I was so bored. I didn't know what to do. I was just, you know, I was just staring at the ceiling. And finally it occurred to me, so you know, well, why don't you start writing? And by that time, you know, I had a laptop, you know, when they were big and clunky and heavy. I had a laptop, and I started writing and really started getting into it. And
you described your first effort as fan fiction. What is fan fiction?
Fan fiction is you play around in a world that someone else has created. You use those characters. You may introduce a few of your own, but the story basically revolves around the characters that inhabit this particular universe. And you can find a lot of fan fiction, a huge amount of fan fiction, on Star Wars, Star Trek, the very popular the very popular shows and movies and things like that. And that's what I was writing. I wrote a piece, my little piece, it was about 40 pages ended up being. I wrote my piece on playing in the universe of Laurel K. Hamilton's Anita Blake series.
Okay. For the audience, number one, she's a vampire hunter, and number two, characters aren't copyrighted. The stories are, but characters aren't. So that's why that you do see all over the internet people writing about Bruce Wayne and Batman, how he got to be Batman, and all these different things. It's their own take on the existing universe, and it's become extremely popular with the internet.
Well, you know, I think also too, it's also spawning maybe I shouldn't use that word spawning, but anyway, it's also spawning a whole new generation of writers. You know, these people, I mean, some of these people are quite good. And so you have these people, and you know, who are writing fan fiction, and maybe, hopefully, they'll branch out and start writing stuff on their own. Yeah, it's a huge world out there. It's a huge world out there. I had no idea. And of course, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. My reason for writing what I wrote when I was sick in bed was simply that I was upset with Laurel K. Hamilton's characters. Upset in the sense that I was pissed at them. You know, come on, guys. You know, come on. You can't tell me that you're acting this way. Here, let me show you how you ought to act. And that's what I ended up doing. And that's how I ended up with my little first piece of fan fiction.
You soon got into your first novel. Tell us about the book.
Well, my first novel, The Underground, it was that's when I started writing, getting into urban fan. And it was basically because of that piece of fan fiction that I wrote that I started getting into urban fantasy as a writer, as well as science fiction, but urban fantasy too. And I wrote the first version of The Underground in 4 months. And needless to say, it took years to write the book that eventually got published. I was lucky enough to find an editor who believed in me and believed in my writing, even though I was a total rank beginner and had no idea what I was doing. And he took it upon himself, really, to teach me how to write a novel, to teach me, you know, the structure, to teach me, you know, the story arc. I didn't know what an arc was. Story arc, what's that? And he taught me all of these things. And he was instrumental, I think, in pushing me along to become, and he was a hard taskmaster. I cannot tell you how many times I had to rewrite chapter one so that it passed muster so I could go on to chapter two. This is not to say that chapter one was acceptable as a finished piece. It was just acceptable so I could move on to chapter two. And that was quite an education. Like I said, it took years. It took years. And of course, again, we were talking, you're talking about old technology. I mean, we were faxing things to each other. And it was, like I said, quite the learning experience. I'm glad I had it, because basically it forms the foundation of everything that I do today, is what he taught me.
Do you use the term urban fantasy? Can you define that for the audience?
Well, urban fantasy is basically, it takes place in an urban setting. And then you have the fantasy creatures. You know, you can have werewolves, vampires, elves, and things like that. But it takes place in an urban setting as opposed to a countryside setting. Or I'll tell you what would be fun is to write a fantasy on the sea,
okay.
An ocean-going fantasy. That would be fun. I may even do that. But that's basically what urban fantasy is. It takes place in an urban area. That's really all it is. And of course, the impacts on the characters are those that occur in urban settings.
After The Underground, there was the second novel. Tell us about that one.
Yes, Mareva of Asteris. First of all, I guess I should say, that novel was way over 30 years in the making. It started out as a collaboration between me and a college friend of mine, and together we wrote this story. Now, I don't remember the details, but I always remember the skeleton of the story, which is essentially that this woman is exiled, this princess is exiled from the kingdom by her father because she won't marry the man he's picked out for. So she's wandering the kingdom, trying to find a village that'll take her in. Well, nobody will take her in. So finally, she turns north. And after a series of adventures, she finds this village in the far north, basically at the end of the world, that agrees to take her in. The village chieftain is enamored of her, but he doesn't want his people to know. So he is very, very kind of hostile towards her. And she doesn't like him anyway. So she's hostile towards him. So after a period of being at each other's throats, they finally relent and realize that they love each other. And so they get married. And meanwhile, her father is feeling remorseful because he has exiled his only daughter. So he goes looking for her. He wanders the kingdom, you know, with his army, looking for his daughter, can't find her. He starts wandering further afield, can't find her. And then finally deducing that his daughter had turned north, he goes that way too. Well, he comes to the village and finds his daughter, and he demands that she return with him, and she says, no, I'm married now and I'm happy. Well, her father threatens war, and the chieftain accepts. And the chieftain and the woman and the princess are killed in the fighting. So that was the skeleton of the story. And years and years later, I read Zechariah Sitchin. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
Well, he wrote, this is great. He wrote a series of books that essentially, in a nutshell, postulates that alien astronauts came to Earth looking for gold. And they created human workers to do the work for them. And in doing so, they founded the Sumerian civilization. Now, Zechariah Sitchin has his scholarly detractors and his loyal adherents, but I got to tell you, it's a great story. It's a tale of a tale. And so anyway, I read the entire series and, you know, was just absolutely fascinated by it and, you know, put it away. And then a number of years again passed, and I was thinking that, let me back up a minute. I was working on a work in progress, and I was kind of at an impasse. I knew what I wanted to do. It was just a question of how to execute it. And I had a whole bunch of ideas in my head, none of which, you know, were really kind of working out. So I sat back and, you know, just kind of like, okay, just put this aside for a minute and just relax, you know, stop worrying at it. So I sat back, I relaxed, and I let my mind wander. And then, you know, I started thinking about my friend when I was in college and the story we wrote. And then I was thinking about Zechariah Sitchin. And then I thought, what if I could meld the two together somehow? Wouldn't that be fun? And that's what I did. And that's where the Mareva of Astoreth came from. It is a melding of a story my friend and I did in college and Zechariah Sitchin's Earth Chronicles series.
Now, had you kept in touch with your friend, and did you know what was going on with the book in the end?
No, unfortunately, we lost touch. We lost touch years and years and years ago. I've been trying to find her on Facebook, but, you know, she may have gotten married and is using her married name, which I would have no way of knowing. But unfortunately, we have lost touch.
In addition to fiction, you also write business-related work, do you not?
Yeah, I'm a columnist for a weekly magazine in my field, and I write articles on various tax topics that I think our readers would be interested in. This last article I just wrote was about the right to taxation and the right to privacy.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. How often are you, a monthly or a weekly columnist, or how often do you write?
It's a weekly column. It's a weekly column. Okay. I'll tell you what, which is a lot harder than I thought. You know, coming up with the topic. In fact, I don't have a topic for this week. So I was thinking maybe I could do something science. How can I meld science fiction and state taxation?
Yeah, I was writing a weekly column on creative disruption, the impact of technology and everything around us that we don't notice till it hits in the face, or till we're walking through a mall and we say, didn't there used to be some music stores here or some camera stores, and they aren't there. And after 212 columns, weekly columns, the newspaper folded. So said I wasn't, that wasn't a lot of fun. I was really into it then. This year you came out with the Underground second edition. What mm-hmm. differentiates the new book from the 2013 book?
Well, a lot, actually. What happened was the reviews I got on the Underground first edition were highly critical, but they were also highly helpful. It was good, constructive criticism. And I thought about it for a couple of years, and I said, maybe I should rewrite the book. You know, so like I said, I was like, well, maybe. But like I said, I kicked it around for a couple of years, and then not having read the book in a couple of years, but keeping in mind their criticisms, I read the book again and realized they were right. And I said, what do I want to do with this? And I'm something of a perfectionist. All right, I am a perfectionist. And I said to myself, you know, I owe it to my readers, not just to my readers, but I owe it to myself to write a better book. And that's what I did. That's why we have the Underground second edition. I had it re-edited by a woman who is an award-winning author in her own right, so it would behoove me to listen to her. I had it re-edited. I took chapters out. I stripped chapters. I added new chapters. I expanded other chapters. It just, in a way, it's the same book, but it's been reshaped. If that makes any sense at all.
Sure.
But
the first book I remember like that I really liked, that was a second edition, was David Gerald's When Harley Was One, version 2.0. And I thought that was just terrific doing it. He's also the fellow that did The Trouble with Tribbles, the Stars episode. Yeah, I had him on the radio too. He's a terrific a terrific interview. So are you happy with the way it came out now?
Yes.
Good.
Yes, terrific. I am. Let's put it this way. I can safely say that it is the canonical Underground. Every other Underground story that I write is going to stem from this book, in the sense of the characters, where they are, how they act and react, and things like that. They will grow and change throughout the series, but this is definitely the basis of where they are. One of the things I'm thinking about doing is writing, like, prequels to all of the main characters. You know, like, one of the things that in the first book, the first Underground, that I didn't explain adequately was how Parker became a werewolf, because he was born human. So how did he become a werewolf? Well, that's a whole story in and of itself. But in the Underground 2, Underground 2nd Edition, I put in, well, he's talking to his alien love, and he says, well, I became a werewolf in college. I drank from a wolf stream, and da-da-da-da-da. So that gives you the bare-bones outline of the prequel.
Okay, sure. Along the way, I believe that you've also have developed a publishing services business. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Black Rose Press. First of all, I publish all of my books through my own publishing company. I do that because it is good for the IRS in some ways. And I also want, well, I also want to publish other writers of color. That's what Black Rose Press, that's my goal with Black Rose Press, is to publish writers of color. You might want to say that at this point I'm the guinea pig. I'm experimenting on myself in terms of publishing books and learning the business. And like I said, eventually I do want to publish things by people of color. And why people of color? Because I think people of color are underrepresented in the science fiction fantasy field. It's not that they're not out there. They're just underrepresented in the published world. Let's put it that way. And I want to do my part to help that happen, to make that happen.
Just, you and I spoke briefly about that before the show, and I raised the question. I go back to Samuel Delaney, and we spoke about Octavia Butler, people that I thought had real talent, and I was surprised that there had been so little black writers that I was aware of in the science fiction. And when we normally think of science fiction and fantasy, because of the different characters and the different everything of being a more democratic, a less bigoted field. I'm surprised that there are so few that I'm aware of anyhow. Do you agree, or am I just missing the good writers that I should know about?
No, I agree. I mean, I think that a lot of people of color, I say people of color because it's not just African Americans. I mean, it's Asians, it's Native Americans, you know. But I think people of color have gotten a short shrift in the publishing industry. One, I think that publishers have decided, whatever, that there isn't a market for it, which is absolutely not true. I think that there has been a little bigotry on their part, that, well, how many of these folks do we want to let in the door? You know, and you got to admit, up until, I guess, the 70s, you know, science fiction fantasy, with the exception of a few intrepid women pioneers, science fiction and fantasy was a white man's world. I'm thinking of Andre Norton, who was a giant. But, her, you know, Andre Norton, you can't tell if she's male or female, you know?
Ursula Le Guin was out there early.
Well, yeah, and she's one of the ones who used her real name. I mean, her, you know, a female name.
Right.
Writing feminist science fiction. But then there's James Tiptree Jr., whose real name was Alice Sheldon.
Right.
You know, she used a man's name so that she could get published.
Right. Which has a long history. If we go back to George Eliot and George Sand, and you know, well,
exactly.
Back to literature. Yeah.
Exactly. Now there were a lot of women writers then, but they were writing for Mrs. Godey's magazine. I mean, they weren't considered. Their writings weren't considered literature.
Right. Mm. Right. But Margaret Atwood's, I think, did a lot to recognize people recognizing a strong feminist science fiction writer. But
yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
So at the present time, you're only publishing your own work, but you want to offer the services to others, obviously, then.
Yes, I absolutely do. And what I want to do is sometime in 2018, please, hopefully, I can open up my doors for submissions. And what I plan to do is publish. Now, this is a basically an ebook and TOD publisher. What I would do is publish the ebook first, and if that does well enough to warrant a POD, a print copy, then we would do a POD. I initially would start out publishing two books a year because there's no point in trying to do too much, see how it goes, and as Black Rose Press grows, then I can publish more books per year, you know, two books, then maybe three books, four books, then five books, six books, you know, that sort of thing.
Are you going to restrict it to science fiction, or will you be open to other genres, or to poetry, or to other non...
Well, no, I'm not restricting it to science fiction. It's Black Rose Press publishes four subgenres: horror, science fiction, fantasy, and weird bizarro.
Okay.
And weird bizarro is roughly new. It's pretty much a new, I think weird bizarro has been around for a long time. People just didn't know what to call it. But in 2005, it finally got a name, weird bizarro, and it's they're stories that are not quite science fiction, not quite horror, not quite fantasy, but there's something weird about them, very strange. And it's definitely like looking at a mirror at a different angle. And so I know that there are a few Black authors who publish weird bizarro, so I would like to bring them into the fold.
Okay. You also mentioned that you have a fourth novel that you're working on. What,
yes.
Is that part of the Underground series, or is it completely
yes.
different? And what's your timetable?
It's the sequel to the Underground. And I am looking at December 2017, January 2018. Yeah, it's ready for the editor. And I just have to see if my editor has time. Hopefully she does. But this is coming right on the heels of the Underground second edition. That's kind of nice, I think.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
if the first one stokes the fire, if you've got a second one, then you're right there. Someone told me a story just the other day when I did a poetry reading. There's a fella in the publishing business, and I happened to mention in one of my poems Joyce Carol Oates. So he said that when she, it was known in the industry that when she signed a four book contract with, I think it was Putnam, I think, the following week, she delivered the first three books. she had everything all ready to go. So
that's right. That's wonderful.
People,
that's a wonderful story.
Some people
but
have tremendous.
That's right. I mean, you know, I hopefully the sequel can ride on the coattails of the Underground second edition. So far, it's getting some pretty decent reviews, unlike the first edition. It's getting some pretty decent reviews. And so I can, so hopefully if I can get, like I said, if I can get this together by the end of the year, then, because the Underground second edition came out on May 10th or May 15th, either one of those two dates. So here we are at the end of the year, and here's the sequel.
What else is next for you, other than these two very heavy things that we just mentioned, the whole new novel and a publishing company?
Well, I guess, like I said, writing. Oh, you know, there's also going to be a. I don't really want to call it a sequel because it's really not. It's another standalone, but it takes place in the Mareva of Asterisk. It takes place in her universe.
Okay.
And so I'm going to be writing a another book in that universe. And the reason why I'm writing it is because so many of my readers have browbeat me. I'm not saying they asked me. They browbeat me. Please write another book. So
how are you going to balance the two book efforts at the same time?
You know what? I have no idea.
Okay.
This is something I have to figure out.
Okay.
I mean, getting the Underground Invasion, that's the sequel, the Underground Invasion published, getting that marketed, writing the Mareva of Asterisk, doing my day job, you know, paying attention to my day job. I already get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, so I can write. That's the only time I have to write. So if I'm doing all of this, I don't know. I have no idea, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
We've covered a good deal of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Roxanne Bland?
Well, I think what they should know is that Roxanne Bland is an alien. She has always been an alien. And this is why she writes such fantastic stories. Because, I don't know, maybe it's because I have a way of looking at the world that is, I don't adhere to any particular creed. I don't adhere to any particular political dogma, any kind of faith or anything like that. And I think that allows me to see the world at a kind of an angle that a lot of people don't see. And so when they read my stuff, they're like, oh, this is really different. And to me, it's just, okay, well, this is the way the world should be. But it's not. So I guess that's one thing I'd like my readers or I'd like people to know about me, is that, you know, I am different. I've always been different, and I'm proud to be different.
Good statement. Thank you, Roxanne. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I also have another book coming out, as is Roxanne's. And I blog at medium.com and publish the daily newspaper I mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week for an interview with Dr. Sheila Murphy, and every other week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And I think I'll go out with Bill Doggett.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Roxanne. Thank you very much.